Hey everyone, just wanted to let you know before you start listening to this special bonus episode that it is going to contain some mature subject matter, so you may want to listen to this one without the kids.
This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigative podcast looking into the 2006 disappearance of Jennifer Kesee in Orlando, Florida. I'm Sean Gerd. Over the course of our last two episodes, we've looked into a witness statement claiming to have seen Jennifer at a jewelry store in Tennessee. All the while, I've kept thinking, does this even make sense? And I know many of you have had the same thoughts. On the last sidebar episode, we were asked a question in that regard about how it doesn't seem like Jennifer would fit into a human trafficking narrative. It's an important question to consider, whether the Tennessee witness saw Jennifer or someone else, because even before this witness came forward, Jennifer's parents have long held on to the theory that she was possibly trafficked. Does human trafficking make sense as a possible motive in Jennifer Kesee's disappearance? It's become time to get an expert's opinion on the matter. So we're releasing this bonus episode to do just that. I've reached out to someone who has a decade of experience in the area of trafficking and sex work. I got in touch to ask her the questions we so desperately needed an authority to weigh in on. She's also the host of a podcast herself, so stick around to the very end of the show to hear more about that. Let's begin by allowing her to introduce herself and define exactly what human trafficking actually is.
Hi, my name is Kenyon Lang. I co-host a true crime comedy podcast called Wine and Crime. But in real life, I'm also a gender consultant. So for the past 10 years, I've worked on gender-based violence issues, mainly working in advocacy and research. And for many years, my main focus was researching prostitution or sex work and sex trafficking issues. So it was actually for this reason that Sean first reached out to me. And I'm a big fan of Unconcluded, and so I was really happy to help out. And I'm just going to take a minute to try to briefly explain the phenomenon of human trafficking a bit, and then also weigh in about this theory regarding Jennifer's disappearance. So first, bear with me. Here is the definition of human trafficking according to the United Nations Protocol to Prevent, Suppress, and Punish Trafficking in Persons. So this is kind of the gold standard in terms of a definition of human trafficking. The protocol defines trafficking in persons as the recruitment, transportation, transfer, harboring, or receipt of persons by means of the threat or use of force or other forms of coercion, of abduction, of fraud, of deception, of the abuse of power or of a position of vulnerability, or of the giving or receiving of payments or benefits to achieve the consent of a person having control over another person for the purpose of exploitation. So, yes, that is a mouthful. There's a little bit more. Exploitation shall include, at a minimum, the exploitation of the prostitution of others or other forms of sexual exploitation, forced labor or services, slavery or practices similar to slavery, servitude or the removal of organs. Okay, so that covers a broad spectrum of things. As you can see, there are different forms of human trafficking. There's labor trafficking, there's trafficking for domestic servitude, there's organ trafficking, and then sex trafficking is another form of human trafficking. So it's not the only form. And there is a really raging debate over whether or not all prostitution is exploitative or not, and whether all prostitution should therefore be considered sex trafficking. But for the purposes of our discussion, I don't think we're going to wade into that debate at all, because it doesn't really relate to Jennifer's case. I will say, just based on the definition that I read to you, that there isn't much distinction between, or any distinction really, between pimping and human trafficking or sex trafficking. So very few legal regimes around the world, even countries where prostitution or sex work is so-called legalized or decriminalized. So even in these places, usually quote-unquote pimping is still not allowed because pimping is so similar to the definition of sex trafficking. And so really almost anywhere, prosecutors in a court of law could choose to kind of aggressively go after so-called pimps by using anti-trafficking statutes and laws. Because again, pimps tend to use threat or use of force. They tend to use coercion. They tend to use fraud, deception, abuse of power, abuse of a position of vulnerability of the victim, or they can kind of coerce a victim to achieve their consent to have control over that person, to exploit them and receive payments or benefits from that person's labor. So based on the definition of sex trafficking, pimping and sex trafficking are basically the same thing. So I probably won't use pimp too much in this discussion, but these terms kind of are interchangeable based on this definition. And then I'm also not going to really go into statistics about human trafficking, and that's mainly because most of the statistics out there are not very reliable. So sometimes the methodology behind getting those numbers isn't very clear, or the research is really outdated, or people have studied one area or one country and then extrapolated to the whole world. So these numbers and statistics about trafficking just aren't that accurate or that reliable. So instead of rattling off statistics, I'm going to talk about trends or patterns in human trafficking that have been observed by researchers, academics, journalists, law enforcement, legal professionals, so people actually working in the field. These are the trends and patterns that they have observed when it comes to human trafficking. And I think that these do seem to be a lot more accurate than some of the numbers out there. And so we can talk about certain predictors of risk for human trafficking based on these trends and patterns. And that's what I'm going to talk about today.
The first thing I wanted to clarify was if Jennifer Cassie would fit the profile of the type of person human traffickers would be looking for. And so the question I asked was basically that. Would Jennifer have been a target of this type of crime?
No. So Jennifer doesn't really fit the profile of a sex trafficking victim at all. Sex traffickers and pimps want people that they can control right away, that they can control from day one. And so that means that they are looking for vulnerable people, which could mean young people under 18 or in their later teens and early 20s, but you know, kind of naive. And so one type of sex trafficking scenario is called a lover boy type of scenario, in which a pimp or trafficker pretends to fall in love with and want to date a particular victim. And then after the victim has fallen head over heels and would do anything for this person, then they are brought into the lifestyle of selling sex. And mostly then the proceeds from selling sex would go to the lover boy. So that is common for younger victims, especially. Alternatively, pimps and traffickers would be looking for someone who is already accustomed to being abused. So maybe a runaway from a sexually or physically abusive home. Some foster kids who have been kind of shuffled around the system haven't found one appropriate family or home, or have been abused by foster parents, just orphans, things like that. So people who have been abused and then are more likely to end up in another abusive situation. Pimps and traffickers also look for people with low self-esteem, people who are lacking resources, so lacking money or lacking friends and family, a personal network that they can rely on if they come on hard times. They are looking for people who are already selling sex or have already sold sex, because then kind of that hurdle to get forcing the victim or preparing the victim to sell sex for them is lower. So that initial hurdle is psychological hurdle is not there because the person has already sold sex. Also, people who have engaged in street sex work or what is sometimes called survival sex are already incredibly vulnerable people. So it's kind of a half dozen, six or half dozen of the other situation. They're looking for people who maybe are using drugs, or alternatively, someone who is afraid of seeking help from the authorities because they have broken other laws, like perhaps they are in the country illegally, or they don't speak the language, or they come from a place where police and law enforcement are not trustworthy. So they're hesitant to go to the police when in trouble, because where they come from, police don't actually help you. They just want bribes, or they commit further abuse against you. So that is the typical victim profile. And from everything that I've heard on the podcast and from the information that Sean has given me about Jennifer, she just doesn't fit this profile at all. So yes, she was young, but she was an adult. She wasn't a teenager. She had close relationships with friends and family, kind of incredibly strong bonds with friends and family. She was in a healthy romantic relationship, so she wasn't looking for a different romantic relationship. She had a good job. She was independent. She lived on her own. She owned her own car. She had good self-esteem. Her mother spoke about her good personal safety awareness, so she wasn't naive. And she wasn't using or addicted to drugs and alcohol. There's really nothing about Jennifer that fits the typical victim profile for a pimp or sex trafficker. Basically, she would just be too difficult a target for them because she had these networks, she had this independence, she had other things going on in her life and going well for her that she would be difficult to obtain or lure, if not impossible. And then even if she had, let's say, been abducted, she would have more of a means of escape than someone who was penniless, didn't speak the language, had low self-esteem, etc. So basically, she's just too difficult to target for pimps and traffickers to make this a very plausible scenario. So this whole idea of sex traffickers just plucking random women from the sidewalk as they're going about their day, you know, like the movie Taken, which is a very entertaining movie, don't get me wrong. I love Liam Neeson, but this whole idea is just basically a complete fallacy. So there are much easier targets out there, and pimps and traffickers will go after easier targets, people that they perceive to be sort of low-hanging fruit.
We also needed to find out if Lisa's story from the jewelry store in Tennessee where she believes she saw Jennifer, would that make sense in a human trafficking scenario?
And so here, it's a little bit more on the fence, but I would still lean towards it being an unlikely sex trafficking scenario. And here's why. So there definitely seemed to be some coercive control happening. So the man was holding the woman's wrist. The woman was hesitant to communicate with the jewelry store worker. And there was the possibility of another person, so possibly a second man waiting in the vehicle. So two men controlling one woman. So all of this, plus the condition of the woman, her clothes, the condition of her just hygiene, these are all red flags, of course, as the jewelry store worker points out. And it's good to pay attention to these things and not brush them off or ignore them. So I do applaud her for pointing all of this out and speaking up. Where it doesn't seem as plausible is just the fact that it's pretty atypical for a pimp or trafficker to bring a victim out into the public, into a jewelry store to pick out jewelry. So that just doesn't seem very likely. So pimps and traffickers, they are in control. They dictate what their victims wear. It's not up to the victims. It's not the victim's choice. The pimps and traffickers control every aspect of that victim's life. So, but bringing someone out to choose some jewelry to wear just doesn't fit that relationship. Also, I don't think a pimp or trafficker would ever allow their victim to wear items of real value. So maybe they'll wear some costume jewelry, especially, you know, while visiting or servicing sex buyers. But I don't think that they would ever be allowed to wear items of real value simply because this could help them escape if they were to choose to try to escape. So they typically aren't allowed to hold on to much money, if any money with them. They, you know, don't always have a phone sometimes. So having jewelry that they could then turn around and pawn or sell to try to escape would defeat the purpose for the trafficker. And then also, there are just much easier means of controlling a victim through bribery, if that is the method of control sought. So many, and again, I don't have statistics, but there is a pattern that pimps and traffickers will keep victims dependent on drugs or alcohol, so illegal substances, because then the victim is easier to control. It's an easy sort of bribery situation, and it also keeps the victim in a state of mind where they're not really equipped to try to escape. Jewelry also just wouldn't be as effective a motivator as an illegal drug that someone was addicted to, right? I mean, jewelry, someone could kind of take it or leave it. It's not going to be the thing that entices a victim to try to stay. And I also just want to point out that the relationship that the jewelry store worker observed could very well be an abusive relationship. Again, all those red flags that were pointed out are very real. But it's not very likely that it is a pimp or sex trafficking scenario.
The last thing I asked Kenyon was about human trafficking in the southeastern United States, in Orlando, in Atlanta, and in Tennessee. What did she know about the possibilities of trafficking in that particular area?
I can't speak specifically about human trafficking in that area because I've mainly worked on these issues in New York City and then also abroad in Europe and Asia. So I haven't worked on these issues specifically in Florida or Georgia. What I will say is that sex trafficking occurs in every major city in the U.S., and it's also common for pimps and traffickers to move victims pretty frequently between cities every few weeks or at the most every few months. And they do this for a number of reasons. So they'll do this because it keeps their victims disoriented. They don't really know where they are. They don't know people where they are. They don't know how to get around. If they were to just walk away, they wouldn't know the lay of the land. And they also are unable to establish relationships, which could potentially help them escape. So, you know, they're not seeing the same sex buyers repeatedly. And so they're not able to even kind of establish that kind of relationship to say, hey, I'm being controlled. Can you help me? They're just seeing new people every night. They'll also do that because it's better for their business. So sex buyers tend to want, to put it really crudely, they tend to want new product. So they're seeking out variety when it comes to buying sex. They don't want to see the same women over and over again. Pimps and traffickers also are better able to pretend to clients that a particular victim is new to the sex trade, even if he or she is not. Then they can demand a higher price for that particular victim. So they can say, hey, this is so-and-so, she's, you know, never sold sex before. And then the client perceives that to be of higher value and they're willing to pay more. And then lastly, but also really importantly, moving victims between cities frequently prevents the police from having time necessarily to prepare a raid or obtain a warrant for arrest. The flip side of that is that when you move someone between state lines for the purposes of sexual exploitation, then it becomes a federal crime. But for it to be human trafficking, it doesn't need to cross any borders. So even if you're just going from one town to another town in the same state, or one city to another city in the same country, it's still human trafficking. You don't need to actually cross a border for it to become human trafficking. And yeah, one other misconception that I want to try to put right is that sex trafficking absolutely occurs in smaller towns and cities. So it's not something that's just in major cosmopolitan cities or urban areas, although it is more likely in those places than in small towns. It's definitely more common in, you know, major thoroughfare cities or towns. So if it's on a major highway or freeway, then it's a little bit more likely than a really remote area, but it does take place in cities and towns of all sizes across the country. So nowhere is completely free of it. And yeah, last but not least, even though I feel really strongly that what the jewelry store worker was describing was not a sex trafficking scenario, there is still a slight possibility that the person that was seen was Jennifer. You know, that's down to the eyewitness, but it's just as likely that the man observed was simply an abductor or a captor and not a pimp or trafficker per se. Okay, so I hope that clears things up a little bit about this theory related to Jennifer's case. I really admire what Sean's doing with the podcast, trying to bring some of this information to light, and I really hope it helps.
The last thing I wanted to make sure that Kenyon had the opportunity to share were organizations or resources that those of you out there listening could support or look to for more information on human trafficking.
The best place to donate would be an organization called Polaris Project that's based in the U.S. Their website is polarisproject.org. That is spelled P-O-L-A-R-I-S ARISproject.org. They run the National Human Trafficking Hotline in the U.S., and the number for that is 1-888-373-7888. And that is both an anonymous tip line. So if you witness something suspicious and you want to report it, but you don't necessarily want to have your name in a report, then you can just call that number and it's anonymous. And it also is a helpline for victims. So if you have been a victim or are a victim currently, then you can call that number directly and they will help you. And then my other piece of advice would be to donate or volunteer at a local domestic violence shelter. So it's not human trafficking per se, but it's definitely vulnerable people who would be likely targets of pimps or sex traffickers if they weren't otherwise receiving help. So that's a great way to help out as well. And it's local, so it's always great to help out in your community where you live. All right, thank you so much. Glad to help out. Bye.
As we digest Kenyon's statements and consider everything we know about Jennifer, it's true. It's hard to imagine her as a target for traffickers. It's a suspicion that many of us have had. Now, confirmed. In the time that's passed since I first heard the jewelry store story from Lisa, I've convinced myself that the person she saw probably wasn't Jennifer. It just doesn't make sense. But it's worth remembering what Kenyon said. Maybe this person that seemed to be in control of the girl at the jewelry store was a captor or an abductor of another sort. We just assumed it would be related to human trafficking. But Kenyon's right. That's not the only scenario in which a person could be held against their will. Now, the good news I can share is that this possible lead, Lisa's story in Tennessee, is now being followed up on by professionals. Since episode 4 has aired, Lisa has been able to get in contact with detectives, and whether or not this lead goes anywhere or not, thankfully, it's being looked at. There's a bit more to that, and we'll get into it in episode 5. There are things that those of you listening who may know something about this crime need to be aware of. Don't forget to stick around to the very end for a promo for Kenyon's podcast, Wine and Crime. And we'll be back in just a few days, this Sunday, with episode 5. I'm Sean Gerd. This has been an unconcluded bonus episode. See you next time.
Hey, true crime fans, have you listened to Wine and Crime yet? We're a new true crime comedy podcast hosted by three childhood friends who chug wine, chat true crime, and unleash our worst Minnesotan accents.
Each week, us gals pick a true crime topic and pair it with a delicious wine before delving into the background and psychology behind the crime. Then we share and speculate wildly about a couple of bonkers cases related to the topic.
Past episodes have included necrophilia, cults, crimes of passion, cruise ship disappearances, exorcisms gone wrong, all this over a bottle of wine, or, let's be real, 3.
We're on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and a number of other podcasting apps. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Wine and Crime Pod, and check out our website and blog at www.wineandcrimepodcast.com.